everyone, and welcome to the next edition of the VTX podcast. Here at the Veterinary Thought Exchange, we like to start by asking, what are you thinking? And this week, I'm going to be thinking and chatting with the incredible Emma Milne. Just to introduce myself, my name is Scott. I'm one of the founders of VTX, and I'm a specialist in small animal internal medicine, and I have the great honour of being your host on our podcast today. Speaking to Emma was, for me personally, an extremely special conversation, because I first saw Emma on our television screens when she appeared in the television show Vets in Practice. And for me as a teenager, thinking about applying to vet school, seeing Emma and her colleagues portraying our profession in such a positive light was personally a massive inspiration to me. So I want to thank Emma for that, and I want to thank her for taking the time to chat to us today. Emma talks about her time on Vets in Practice, but also about her incredible career in veterinary medicine, especially focusing on the very important work she has done promoting animal welfare. We are thrilled also to be joined for our clinical segment today by Johnny Lambert from Zoetis. Johnny is here to continue a series of clinical discussions supported by Zoetis, all about dermatology. And actually, this is Johnny's second appearance in our podcast, so we're very happy to welcome people back. Today, we're going to be talking about therapeutics in canine allergic skin disease, considering some of the short and long-term considerations regarding effective diagnostics, and also some of the decision-making around the therapy that we use. So massive thank you to Johnny and Zoetis for our clinical chat today. Okay, so Emma, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today. I wonder, not that you need any introduction, obviously, but I wonder if you could start just by introducing yourself to the listeners, and I suppose just telling us a little bit about your veterinary background, if that's okay.
So I qualified from Bristol in 96, which suddenly seems a super long time ago, and was just planning to go into general practice and be just a normal vet, and then very quickly became quite upset about breed related issues that I was seeing. And I guess the biggest thing that was different for me from other people was that we were ended up by complete coincidence being on a program called Vets in Practice, which ran for 11 series and 4 Christmas specials, and became this just absolutely mad sensation at the time. So I was quite lucky. I was in all 11 of those series, and it gave me a platform, I guess, to sort of reach a lot of people that I wouldn't have done if I'd been in practice.
So I just have to, I don't know if you get this a lot, but I'm going to just be very honest. I mean, I genuinely, did very much, I don't want to make you feel or sound really old, but grow up or be, very aware of you as when I was in high school, so I get that. I'm just being honest. So, you were very much in television at the time where I was making decisions about my own career, and and I don't know if it makes you cringe or recoil, when people say stuff like this to you, but television shows like the one that you were on, I think definitely did have an influence, certainly on me, but on other people.
Yeah.
Are you aware of that? Is that something that you're aware of? Does that still come up?
Yeah, really, really very much. And I think we were just that, because for my generation, I'm not offended by thinking, I've suddenly realized I'm 52, and I'm like, well, how on earth am I now 52? But when I was a kid, I can't remember. I wanted to be a vet since I was about 6 or 7. And so I used to watch James Herriot all the time, which was our program that made everyone want to be vets. And I can't remember if I watched that because I wanted to be a vet or vice versa, chicken and egg. But, when Vets in Practice was at its height, we were regularly getting between 8 and 10 million viewers a week, which is unheard of now that there are lots of digital channels. So we were incredibly famous. And it was very surreal because we were still just normal people living normal lives. It was kind of a fly on the wall thing. But in that time that I was very in the public eye, loads of people came up to me and in the years afterwards said, "You're the reason I went to vet school." And it's in some ways you sort of feel like it's a big pressure thing, because what if they made the wrong decision? You know, we know how much depression and, you know, suicide and things there are in our profession. But equally, then some people are just, you know, there was a mature student who came up to me at Spiv's Lancaster conference where we were speaking, and she said, "I can't believe I'm meeting you. You're the whole reason I'm here." And she made that decision later in life. And so from that point of view, it's a massive honor, you know, that, that you can touch someone's life like that.
And I think it's true, isn't it funny? Like even now, like I only met you for the first time in person in November last year. And, you know, we met at the Royal College Fellowship Day in the UK. But I, you know, when I met you, it's that funny thing where, I mean, I completely knew who you were and felt like I wanted to say something to you, because I felt, you know, it was that weird thing that's, you know, that weird, I honestly, again, and you do feel a little bit like you know someone, but you've never met them before, because you've seen them on television. It is a very odd thing. And it's funny how, you know, we're talking about obviously years down the line, and that still has that effect on me, although we are both obviously at very different parts of our career. So it's a funny thing. And it's lasting. Like it's, you know, it's still something that's around today. I wonder, you know, it's always interesting with these, with any sort of thing like this, where, you know, when it comes to doing something that's a bit outside what we would normally do as vets, do you remember the moment where this TV show kind of crept into your sphere? Do you remember the moment where it became like, oh, we're potentially going to do this? You know, I presume you were asked if you wanted to be a part of it, or maybe you weren't, I don't know, but do you remember when that kind of was an idea that you had to sort of say yes or no to?
I mean, so for us it started in our final year at vet school, because I went to Bristol University, and Bristol's got a huge natural history. The BBC, the natural history unit, is based in Bristol. So that, you know, I had the massive honor to meet David Attenborough one day, which just blew me away. He's my biggest hero, so much so that I almost didn't go because I was so frightened I put so much on it. But yeah, so BBC Bristol came to meet some of the students and things just before our final year, with a look to making a program called Vet School, which was going to follow if they found, you know, some interesting characters in our year. They were going to make this program about our final year and our exams and so on. And we had a great year at university. We were a really close-knit year, very loads of really different characters, different walks of life and so on. And I wasn't actually filmed for vet school. And then I think they thought it was going to be a one-off. And then during the summer holiday after we all left, I got a phone call from the BBC, because I'd been filmed a little bit, but I wasn't in the programme. And they rang me up and said, "We're going to make a follow-up. It's been really popular. We're going to make a follow-up called Vets in Practice. Do you want to be in it?" And I sort of thought, well, it'll, you know, be one season and it'll be my, you know, 5 minutes of fame or whatever. And it just went completely ballistic. You know, I've been recognized on holiday all over the world. And in fact, so that ran till 2003. And I moved to France 8 years ago. And about 3 years ago, I was helping out in the summer holidays. A friend of ours had a restaurant here and they were really short staffed. So I said, "Oh, I've done loads of waitressing before. If you want me to take some weekend shifts, I'll do that." And a big group of English people said to me, "I know this is mad, but are you that vet off the telly?" And this is,
you were waiting their table.
Yeah. This is like 15 years after it finished, not after it started. And I said, I said, yeah, you know, because we had so many viewers, people watched it religiously. And because it followed our private lives, people felt like they like you say, they felt like they genuinely knew us. And you would have people come up to you in supermarkets and say, "Oh, hi, Emma, how are you?" And of course, as a vet, you'll know this. If someone comes up to you out of context with no animal, you're like, "Oh, can I place them? Can I place their animal?"
100%.
And for us, it was one step next because it's like, "Are they a client? Have they just seen us on TV?"
I think unless they've got the, you're absolutely right. Unless they've got the identifier, which is the animal beside them, actually, it can be quite difficult to recognize them. That's so true. But also, that's quite trippy. I mean, let's be honest. You're in, first of all, you're in France. You're serving people in a restaurant, and they're like, "Wait a minute, I definitely saw you. Her career's taken a different turn. What is she doing here?" You know. But so I think there's a lot of things that's quite, you know, out of context on that situation. Do you?
But you know, I mean, something that was lovely the other day, because I do technical consulting, nutrition consulting for Hills. And I was talking to a lovely vet in Ireland a few weeks ago, and I did the whole consultation about this case that he had. And at the end of it, he said, "Can I ask you something else?" And often it's that, "Oh, while you're here, can I ask you about a different case?" And I was like, "Yeah, of course you can." And he said, "Are you the Emma Milne from Vets in Practice?" And this was like a colleague. And I said, "Yeah," because a lot of people recognize my terrible Kent accent. And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Oh, I just wanted you to know that I think it's brilliant what you've used that platform for." You know, and it's things like that that really touch you. For me, that, you know, that really stayed with me. I've had a lot of abuse over the years for various reasons. And just those comments make you carry on putting up with it all.
So that, I suppose, let's talk about that then. So you, is there kind of, is there any sort of, is there a bit of a come down from all of that malarkey, you know, as far as you kind of are riding this wave of 8 million viewers a week? And I mean, those are like, it sounds like X Factor numbers, you know, when they used to be like 10 million people, you know, that's like strictly numbers. Like it's, you're absolutely right. I think there's very few, TV is not an event anymore. You know, as far as like, there's very few, because it's all on demand, isn't it? So I think that, unless you've got like a Happy Valley or something that everyone's tuning in for, then I think that you don't really get that same television viewing experience. And so it really was, I mean, that's incredible that 8 million people would tune in. So I suppose you know, you've got your career, you're kind of doing the job that you thought you were going to do, but people are kind of watching, and, you know, and then is it funny when that ends? Were you affected, do you think, when the TV cameras weren't there? Was that affect you?
Yeah, it was really odd. It was quite funny, actually, because we did hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of interviews for magazines and radio and TV and stuff over the years that we were on it. And lots of times I was asked, isn't it odd having your life filmed? But the crazy situation was that since I left university, I had never for 7 years not had my life filmed. So it became this... I mean, they weren't there all the time, don't get me wrong. They'd come for like a week at a time, or, you know, depending on what cases we had in and so on. But because they followed our personal stuff, it got to the point when they stopped, I was really disappointed. But then also you had this thing where Julie, who was the nurse that I worked with for years and years, we were so, so geared up. If we had something interesting came in, I really clearly remember a couple of weeks after it finished, we used to do wildlife rehabilitation work, and we had a duck brought in that had swallowed a fish hook, and it had this great x-ray, and it was a great story, and it was going to get operated on and released. And my immediate reflex reaction was to ring the BBC. You know, I had a big birthday, and it's like, "Oh, we're going to have a big party. Do you want to come and film it?" And then it was like, hang on, this is totally out of kilter with normal life. So that was the weirdest thing, was them not filming us anymore, because we were just so habituated to it.
But do you not think that put kind of like, we're already under like massive pressure, particularly as new graduates, did you never feel Did you never feel that that was even more pressure being piled on because people were watching even more what you were doing, particularly when you maybe didn't know what you were doing? I mean, maybe you did always know what you were doing, but certainly as a new
No,
grad.
it's certainly not. I mean, I look back now at some of those early episodes, and my kids are 12 and 14, and they've now found some of the old episodes of it on YouTube, which they think is absolutely hilarious. So now they're getting all their French friends to watch it as well. But I think two things about that, and obviously people will have different views of it, and not everyone enjoyed it. And I think I was always not confident in my abilities, but confident in making decisions, I think. It's difficult to remember because it's 20 years ago now, but I was terrified about going into practice. So the fact the cameras were there was, I mean, paled into insignificance compared to how terrified I was of having to make a diagnosis on day one. And I think all vets go through that. And one of the vets I worked with said, listen, the difference between how you feel today to tomorrow will be completely different. And the way you feel at the end of this week will be different. And the way you feel at the end of this month will be different. And they were really wise words. So no, the cameras and quite quickly, because we had often had the same people filming us, it just ended up feeling like you had your friends with you at work. And I know there were vets who fell out with crews. I know there were vets who hated it. And I know there were vets who definitely felt pressured by it. But for me, on the whole, it was an incredibly positive experience, particularly because it has given me the opportunities to do a lot of the welfare stuff that I've done.
And so I suppose then you did sort of mention this a little bit, about potentially some negativity. I would say, from my own personal perspective and all of this, I would say that you and your colleagues that were kind of featured in this way really did, I think, a wonderfully positive thing for the profession. I think really that was a time where I think, public perception of vets was really positive. I think that it was really kind of, there was something really deeply, I don't know, like there was a real love for it. People really thought it was just the most wonderful job, and it came across so well, I think, on television, and so it was very positive. I'm not sure that we're in that space anymore. So I think that's interesting that tides change and perceptions change, but I think you were really part of a very positive time for the profession, particularly from the public perspective. I'm sure you're very aware of how things have changed over time, and the difference maybe till now. Do you think that the public look at vets differently now versus then? Is that, do you feel that change?
That is a really great question. And I was about to knee-jerk say yes. And then I had a thought came that I've not thought of before. You just said that. I think that probably it's the echo chamber effect of social media. I think one of the biggest differences when we qualified, social media didn't exist. And I don't think you can underestimate the massive double-edged sword that that can be. And I, because of the welfare and ethics stuff I do, I get contacted by a lot of vets and nurses when I do talks, when I, set up the website about brachycephalism. I have been contacted by a lot of vets who are under incredible abuse. I mean, receiving horrible abuse from people online. So when you said, has the perception changed? I do wonder whether we're just hearing the vocal minority, which is always the case, isn't it? When I was in practice, 85% of my clients were absolutely lovely people. But of course, you go home at the end of the day, and the only ones you remember are the people who were horrible to you, or were rude, or were expecting too much, or, So I think it's that classic human nature that we're particularly as vets, because we're perfectionists and we want to do our best. I think it's very easy for us to get hooked on hearing the negative stuff. So, and I always love to think that the vast majority of people are lovely, but unfortunately, they're not the ones who speak out.
The
So I
silent
suspect that,
majority.
yeah, I think that there's probably a load of people that still think vets are amazing, and still love their vet and are really grateful for everything they're doing. But sadly, it's this, that the keyboard warriors that are misguided or angry or having a bad day that, are frankly causing some people to commit suicide, which is just a tragic state of affairs, isn't it?
Oh, it's t I mean it, it well, I suppose when you say it as plainly as that, like, I mean it's so devastating, really. But I think it's 100% the world that we live in. I think, I remember, again, not to age you, Emma. I don't want to keep bringing
I've had
age
no qualms
into
about my age at all, so don't
but
worry about it.
I remember creating a Facebook. I vividly remember when I created my Facebook profile. I was in the final year of my vet school, but that was, it's still a long time ago. This is, but that was just becoming a thing as I qualified. And my first Facebook profile photo was me and a penguin at Edinburgh Zoo in my final year rotation. I remember that very vividly. But I think, the thing is, you don't you I've talked about this a number of times with different people in the profession. I spoke to the very wise Rosie Alistair and actually and Daniela DeSantis about microaggressions and different things. So even within the profession and actually online, the loudest voices are always those at the extremes, right? I think, and it really is the silent majority that we're forgetting about, the people that have opinions but just don't want to sit and type them out. And I think that's a really interesting answer to that question, because I thought you were just going to be like, yes, it's totally different, everyone hates vets, but that's what you've said is actually really true, that that's probably not true, but the world and the way that we communicate in the world has totally changed. And I think that's really, really interesting. You did.
I would love that. I'm really, really proud of being a vet. And I'm over the years, when I hear people say things like, you only recommend premium dog foods because you make money out of it, you only recommend vaccines because you make money out of it, you only do this because you make money out of it, I find that absolutely soul destroying. And I know that lots of vets do, because the job is so hard and it's so stressful, and we put our absolute heart and soul into it. So for someone not only to say that you're in it for nefarious reasons or imply that it's not because it's for animal welfare, any of those things, I take incredibly personally, and I take it personally for the rest of the profession. And those new graduates, I was rung up by a graduate who said he was upset about extreme confirmation, the same as me. And she said, I've been qualified 6 months and I want to leave the profession. I've got people abusing me, and all I'm doing is treating French bulldogs every day. And that's, she's put all of that work in, and 6 months in, she's on her knees. And I just think that's just so sad compared to how we qualified and the work that we went into.
I went into my son's school recently, to mock interview one of the sixth form pupils for vet school, and she ended up getting into Edinburgh Vet School, which is where I went, the superior vet school, Emma.
All right.
We'll talk about that another time. At least it's not Cambridge. No, I'm joking. I'm not really. She was so full of hope and optimism and excitement, and it really just filled my heart with like just joy. And that's the way I felt, when I was applying to vet school, got into vet school. I'll never forget that joy, that feeling that I got. And I know we can't, I know that's not real life, and I know that you can't, being a student is very different from real life, but I think it is sad that we end up with people that are phoning you up, 6 months in and having those sorts of concerns about, their career. I mean, it's difficult. And I know the solution to that is challenging. But what I would say And it is that you as an individual then are actually extremely important now, because you are someone who has, you know, had a longer, you know, career, who has from certainly from the outside made that career work for them. That's how I perceive what you're doing, you know, and I think that's really powerful, like to see people doing the job, continuing to do the job, but doing the job in a way that still makes them passionate, I think is really inspiring to see. So I suppose my question is, you're still a vet.
Yeah.
And you're not on, you know, being recorded on a television show anymore, but you're still doing the job. What, tell me about your job now. What gets you out of bed now? What gets you passionate now? And what makes you still love this profession today?
Oh God, there's loads of things. I've been really lucky actually, because I left clinical practice in 2008, and I know that a lot of people, and I've spoken to lots of vets who I absolutely admire as heroes in our profession, who aren't in clinical practice. And we all say, yeah, you know, my parents don't think I'm a real vet. You know, as soon as you leave clinical practice, it's almost like you've stopped being a vet. But actually, I think that in the time since then, I would like to think that I've made a much bigger difference to animal welfare than being in practice. And that is the whole remit of being a vet, is to improve animal welfare. So it's funny actually, because of the stuff I've done about breed related disease, there are days, I mean, I'm not upbeat all the time. There are days that all I see is disease. I live in the south of France, hottest place in France, and I'm surrounded by French bulldogs. So there are times that I think, oh, I wish I didn't know any of this stuff. You know, I just wish I could stop thinking about it. You know, it's been 25 years. I've been campaigning on this. I've been doing all this stuff. And sometimes I get tired. And years ago, when I had the worst of the abuse that I've ever had, when people were saying stuff about my kids and my parents, and I said to my husband at the time, I'm jacking all of this in. And this is a bit of a tangent, but I was having this dreadful online abuse, almost death threats. And I was awake in the night. I don't sleep very well anyway, but I was reading all these, this diatribe on Facebook about how awful I was, and really in a bad way. And I got this Facebook message from a vet in Asia somewhere saying, I'm so sorry about what's happening to you. I want you to know that anyone here who wants to buy a brachycephalic animal gets given articles that you've written, excerpts from your books. I want you to know you're making a difference all over the world. And that one, that's made me quite emotional. That one thing just makes you carry on. You know, it suddenly negates the 2,000 people saying they wish I was dead. And so I think it's things like that. It's interactions with vets like that. Last week I was speaking in Norway and Croatia, and it's interesting seeing cultural differences. And I like speaking to nurses particularly as well. I think they're facing a lot of ethical dilemmas that vets put on them. I think vets are facing a lot of ethical dilemmas, and I think a lot of vets feel they can't speak out, or they're too small in a big company to speak out, or they can't make an individual difference. And it's been easy for me to put my head above the, well, it hasn't been easy, but maybe easier than some to put my head above the parapet, because I haven't been in practice seeing clients on a day-to-day basis and having those pressures from management if they exist. But one of the things I love most about what I do now is speaking to other vets. And, you know, in Norway, obviously there are cultural differences. I'm speaking in China next year. I spoke in Orlando in the US, and those cultural differences are huge. And in Norway, I said to them, you know, I said, look, is this just me? Is it just the UK? Are you seeing these problems? Do you feel like this? And, you know, people are sometimes timid to speak up. And at the end of it, one of the women said, I just wanted to say one of the best things that's come out of today is that I know I'm not alone. So, you know, it's things like that that keep me really passionate about it. Obviously, I'm still doing all the stuff I'm doing for animal welfare, but I think I'm part of a much bigger picture that I think the breed related stuff that I've been campaigning about is actually having a huge mental impact on our profession. And if I can be there for the animals and the humans, then that is incredibly satisfying job. It doesn't pay very well, but I do have some other jobs that do keep my children in food and me in.
Is that waitressing or other things? Or
no, what? I haven't done any waitressing for a couple of years. I was just helping my friends out, but no, I still do the clinical. I do some occasionally do clinical nutrition stuff. I do a lot of writing.
I think
I'm lucky. I can put. I've got a lot of what is it? Fingers in pies.
But then that's about, I think that's about career creation and I think that's fine. Like I also have many fingers in pies and it, you know, and I think that works for me, you know, so I think it's about creating sometimes a set of things that kind of keep you sort of stimulated. I think that the interesting thing about, you know, some of the issues that you've chosen to sort of campaign or speak or be involved with, you know, particularly the breed related stuff, so that, you know, brachycephalic conformation and the issues associated with that, and also, you know, you mentioned their nutrition. It just so happens that they are two of the most contentious things that you could be involved in, as far as, like, you know, when you, like, you know, like, I think there's certain things that just seem to just inflame people, as far as that, particularly online, you know. And I think that, and I've spoken to other, you know, kind of vets with a bit of a media or a social media presence certainly before about this, like, you know, you these topics just seem to really get people going, you know. And I even in my, you know, in my sort of clinical work, I sometimes find myself shying away from discussions about certain things, because I know that the, you know, raw feeding or just nutrition in general, or, you know, I mean, I do find myself kind of recoiling sometimes, because I just think it gets people really care about these things, you know. And I think, you know, what was interesting, you talking about the brachycephalic stuff, this stuff is still front and center, as far as it does feel like it's still very much a problem. And actually, in some ways, and I don't want to underplay the work that you've done.
No, you go ahead, because I feel like it's got worse, if that's what you're about to say.
All right. Yeah, but I didn't mean that I really want to say, you know, the stuff you've done.
I completely understand and I completely agree.
But what I mean is, like, what I mean is, obviously, you know, the popularity of the French Bulldog particularly is now so high, as far as just pure numbers on it. You know, I was, and also, obviously, there was recently at Crufts in the UK, there was, you know, the French Bulldog won whatever it won, like the best of breed,
yeah.
Breed, you know. So my point being is that these problems still need to be spoken about. These problems are not disappearing. Would you agree? Like, they're still relevant and important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, I think over the years, there are times I just feel demoralized. You know, I have been doing this for 25 years and I feel like conformation's got worse. But the thing is that, as I said, I used to get loads of abuse about what I was saying. And now, touch wood, I don't get very much at all. And I think it's just because it felt for a long time that I was one of the very few people saying it. So everyone thought that I must be mad. And now, actually, no one can argue with it. So at least I think the progress that I kind of have to tell myself there is that lots more European countries are making laws about it. There are people trying to get EU-wide law made about it. Everyone is talking about it. I'd like them to talk about more than just brachycephalism, because there are 30 or 40 breeds of dogs that are suffering, well, and many cats and other species as well. So I think there's progress in some ways, but I think the conformation's got worse. And for me, all the time that it is not illegal to breed animals that will suffer, we can't blame people for buying them.
No. Because, and yeah, and I do, you know, I genuinely think that that's really important, and I don't want to, for what my two pence worth is, very much that sometimes I think the profession gets it wrong, as far as the stigma that we put on people for having some of these types of animals. And I think that's unfair because people, actually the majority of people that own French bulldogs want absolutely the best for that French bulldog. They don't potentially understand all of the issues that are associated with the breed. And these people are they love their animals, and we need to be able to work, you know what I mean? So I think there's a lot of education, but I think we've got to be careful not to stigmatize people and a breed. You know, we've got to, do you know what I mean? Like there's a really, I think it's important that we work with people so we're not isolating ourselves and we're not isolating them for what.
Well, also the animals that are there need our care, you know.
Of course.
Years have said to me, oh, you hate French bulldogs. Like, I don't, I love dogs. This is the whole reason I'm so upset about it, is I love dogs. I don't think that it is ethical to perpetuate breeding of animals that we know will suffer as tangibly as if they were being beaten every day.
Yeah.
And I you know, that's one of the things I always say in my talks is I think we really underestimate the unnecessary suffering that those breed standards cause. We know they're going to suffer.
So if you, I mean, if you could, if you, it, you know, there's obviously this is, if you could, if you had a magic wand and you could wave it today, what would you, what change, what one change do you think is you would make immediately? What do you think is an important thing that we need to be thinking about doing?
Everyone's going to think I'm mad, but when I was a kid, if you wanted a dog or a cat, there was always, we used to call them Heinz 57s. I said that to someone recently. They're like, what? You know, it was a Heinz 57 variety. You couldn't tell what it was. It was like a medium-sized dog. You know, that's what you'd go to the RSPCA, or someone had an unwanted litter.
A collie cross.
Yeah, some sort of thing that had a bit of black and white in it. And and it feels like since then we have, as a society, and again, I think this is driven by social media and celebrity culture, we've become completely obsessed with breeds and attention-seeking through our animals. Look at me with my, you know, teacup chihuahua on social media, you know, all of these things. And if I could wave a wand, I would go back to having family pets that were healthy crossbreeds. They're beautiful, individual, unique animals. You know, this drive to have something that's so weird that someone in the street will say to you, oh my God, what's that? I want to get one. You know, I don't know if you've seen these Dwarf cats now that are a cross between a Sphinx cat and a Munchkin cat. So these cats have got no skin, no hair, sorry, they have got skin, no hair, no whiskers, no legs, virtually no legs. So they can't climb, they can't groom, they can't go up and down stairs, they can't scratch posts. Those animals are incapable of living a cat's life, and we've done that deliberately. If it was me, I would just go back to, we don't need breeds, we need healthy family pets with good temperaments.
And it's so true, and embracing the individual rather than striving towards a specific aesthetic. But I think we can probably take that into our own lives as well and just get rid of social media actually altogether.
Yeah,
so that's the answer.
But this that's is a bit, the big thing, that it's the species. People don't understand that breeds don't exist in nature. And to me, we should be caring for the welfare of the species, not the breeds. So when people say, oh, well, these breeds are dying out, we must save them, they're rare breeds. Who cares? We should be looking after the species, the welfare of the species.
God, you know, not, that is so, no one has ever said that to me in that, or like, I've never heard that in that way before. Breeds do not exist in nature. Should we get t-shirts? Do you want to get that on a t-shirt? Well, I'll get t-shirts made for us. That's a good thing.
Brilliant.
Like, I think,
let's do it.
You know, but that's incredibly powerful. Like, I think that's the kind of thing that we need, a whole website that's just that.
Yeah. they are a completely man-made concept. So, and you will have had these conversations with people where you'll talk about Frenchies being ill or Dachshunds having spine disease or whatever. And someone will say, oh, are they not a natural breed then? And I always say, none of them are natural. If we stopped breeding dogs, pedigree dogs tomorrow, they would all disappear. Nature would not select them. You know, and my other thing is, I always wanted to say to clients, would you like a pedigree dog or an inbred one? And they always say, oh, I don't want something that's inbred. I want a pedigree, because pedigree sounds really fancy and nice and superior. And inbred gives all the connotations of jokes about humans living in small villages and interbreeding. And pedigree dogs are the most inbred things on the planet.
It's just language, though, isn't it? I mean, it's just language. And, you know, it's language and how, you know, and the just the power of certain words and what that conjures up. But I think, but it really is about just, it's so interesting you said about that kind of, you know, really all, you know, that the direction that we're going in with social media, particularly with, is just that, you know, pushing us towards looking a certain way, being a certain way, you know, doing certain things that are deemed to be like glamorous and sexy and whatever. And it all kind of just feeds into that, doesn't it? Because I've got this, like, so my French bulldog's now got long hair and it's got tricolor and it's, you know, so it's even more like, it's more and more and more, and we're just that, you know, further extreme. And I suppose it's just such an unhealthy direction for us to go in humans and dogs and cats and everything. You know, it's just, that's just the wrong direction. Yeah, okay, we're gonna get a line of merchandise with all of these things on it, right? So that's our next diversification. You heard it here first. So actually, you know, amongst all of this, our conversation started with me telling you that you know, inspired me. I hope that's not cringy. I'm actually saying that because it's true.
I'm super honored.
So but I suppose I want to ask you then, who inspires you?
As I said earlier, I think David Attenborough is one of the greatest men that has ever lived. I think his attitude to nature and the natural world and the way we treat the planet and the way we treat each other. And I got the book The Trials of Life was one of the TV series that changed my life, I think, from a natural history point of view. There are loads of modern day vets that inspire me. You know, one thing that's been really humbling for me is even things like the fellowship process. I hate self-nomination. The only reason I went for it in the end was because I thought it would give me a chance to reach more people. And I asked people for personal statements for me. And these are people that I really look up to in the veterinary profession, like Claire Rusbridge and Heather Bacon. And these sort of, I mean, Heather Bacon to me is this welfare guru. And then I saw the things that they'd written about me. And it was just incredible. It was the most humbling thing I've ever experienced. So I think, you know, vets that spring straight to mind, Claire Rusbridge, Heather Bacon, Sarah Heath, you know, the things that they've been through, the people they reach, how passionate they are. I don't know, there's loads of them. I you know, but I think from a celebrity point of view, I think David Attenborough, without question, is top of the top.
That's an incredible. And so just talking about celebrities, have you met anyone else? Lady Gaga, Adele, they're always my favorites. No.
I've met loads of celebrities. One of the most surreal nights I ever had was we got nominated for a TV award years ago, and they asked, four of us were allowed to go, and they asked me if we won if I'd give the speech anyway. So we ended up going to the Royal Albert Hall, I think, and there were just like proper celebrities everywhere. Mm. You know, all the cast of EastEnders and Coronation Street, and I mean big proper celebrities. And afterwards, who was it? Someone really famous from a soap opera, this is showing how long ago it was, came up to us afterwards and said, oh, I'm so pleased you won that. You totally deserve it. I love your show. And we were like, what?
Yeah.
So crazy, yeah, I have met quite a few. Yeah.
But it's funny, isn't it, when people, I was talking to Jade from Street Vet recently, and we were talking about, you know, celebrities and that thing where it was Paul O'Grady she was talking about, you know, and actually one of the things she was saying was that, you know, he was exactly what you thought he would be, and he wasn't a disappointment. You know, a lot of celebrities are like, you know, you meet them and they're awful to you.
Yeah, and you're really worried that it's going to be a huge disappointment.
But she was saying that actually he was everything that she expected and more. So that was nice when celebrities don't
I
disappoint.
met him. He was lovely. And that reminded me actually, because the last time I saw him, Brian May was there as well. So I met Brian May, and because I do quite a bit of stuff with I4, I presented Brian May with an award one year as well. So I've actually met him twice.
I love that you just were like, oh yeah, Paul O'Grady. Also, Brian May was there. Yeah, I mean, I've presented him with an award. That was very, you did that very casually. That was a bit.
It's mad, cool. Isn't it? And then, you know, I ended up on a judging panel for some animal awards with Donald McIntyre, the undercover investigator.
Oh, yeah.
It was absolutely lovely. And then ended up, you know, you end up with these people's numbers in your phone book, and you're like, this is just mad. So there was one time I was going to London, and I said to him, oh, if you're in London, do you fancy getting together for a drink? Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah, sure. Let's go to the Ivy or whatever. And I mean, I never go places like that. It's mad. So
I love that. I love that. But that's fun, you know.
Completely surreal period of my life.
Yeah, no, it's very cool. It's very cool. You know, I think one of the things that we like to ask people and hope that they answer honestly, if you were to, you know, go back to that point in your life where you were making that application to Bristol Vet School, if you were to go back there now, would you still put in that application? Would you still apply to vet school? Would you still do that again today with the power of hindsight?
I've thought about this many, many times in my career, and I absolutely, without doubt, 100%, I definitely would. There have been periods in my life where, if you asked me, I probably would have said no. I've had some low points, which I'm sure everyone does. But yeah, without a shadow of a doubt, I think the veterinary degree, and I think one of the reasons that a lot of people get depressed and fed up in practice is because we strive to be that proper vet that's in practice. And I think it takes a lot of us. It took me many, many years to admit that that was not for me. And I think we have to get over that feeling that if you're not in practice, you're somehow not a real vet. And I think it's letting go of that and admitting to yourself that you made a mistake, particularly the kind of people that get selected for vet school. I think we're our own worst enemies in a lot of ways. But yeah, I definitely would. I would probably not go into clinical practice. I would probably go into practice, but do charity work or travel and do wildlife work. I did some work in the townships in Johannesburg and Cape Town with I4. And it was shortly after that I left practice in the UK, because I was treating dogs and cats that were malnourished and riddled with parasites and so on. But they were lovely animals. Their owners desperately needed help. The animals needed help, but they were these robust individuals that I was sort of talking about. And so I'd love to go and do more work with communities like that, where you feel like you're really making a difference rather than just curing diseases that we have specifically bred into animals for the way they look.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that I was speaking to another internal medicine specialist the other day where we were, I took a period of, you know, not doing clinical work, doing sort of telemedicine, and both of us were like, oh my God, we felt like we'd failed, you know, not being in practice. And I really do think that that's so important, that we move away from that feeling. And it's, you know, this career can be so many different things to so many different people in so many different ways. And I think that's really important that we 100% embrace that. If you were
but
to give
that
one
thing that you can reach animals without touching animals on a daily basis. I think that if I was going to say anything to people who are struggling in practice, it is, you can do incredible stuff for animal welfare without being in a consulting room or behind an operating table. Sorry, I completely cut you off then.
No, well, funnily enough, my next question was actually exactly, was if you were to give one piece of advice to people that were listening, what would that one piece of advice be?
I think it would be to stay open-minded, that you are a vet. If you have a veterinary degree, it doesn't matter what you do within that whole veterinary world, that whole animal welfare world, you know, you are still making a difference as a veterinary surgeon, as we'd call them, or a veterinarian is the more common term around the world. I think if you're in a job, one of the things that I've had over the years is people saying to me, I can't speak out in my job because I might lose my job. I can't express my ethical dilemmas, da, da, da. If you are in a practice that is making you miserable, then you should leave. And you should either find a practice with a boss who is better for you, or find another way to use your veterinary career. Don't be afraid to leave practice, because if you stay in that job, I can tell you, you will hit rock bottom the same as I did 3 years in. And it's no good for you or the animals in your care.
Yeah, and I think that's, it's no, yeah, exactly. It's no good for anyone, really. I mean, really, and mostly for yourself, which is important. But you're right, it just doesn't serve anyone well at all. So then we'll finish by asking you, what do you want to be when you grow up?
That's a great question. Is it really corny and trite to say happy? I have just been through quite a rough year. And yeah, when I grow up, I want to be a vet and happy and see my kids be happy, hopefully, and successful. And I would love to feel like I've made a difference to some people and lots of animals. So yeah, what do I want to be when I grow up? Is happy.
I think that's a great answer. Well, listen, thank you so much for taking time to chat to me today. It's been such an honor, and I do feel a wee bit kind of I feel slightly emotional, I don't know why, but I feel it's an honor to speak to you, truly, and you really are honestly an inspiration to me, so I thank you for that.
Really kind of you to say thank you. It really does mean a lot to me. It really does.
So we're just leading into our clinical segment now. It's just to remind you that the clinical segment is supported by Zoetis and is intended for members of the veterinary profession. So by continuing to listen, you confirm that that describes you. Okay, so hi, Johnny. Thanks so much for joining us today. I wonder, just before we launch into our chat, it would be good for you just to introduce yourself to the listeners and just tell us a little bit about what you are doing on a daily basis.
Okay, yeah. So great to be here on the podcast as well. So my name's Johnny Lambert, and I'm a national veterinary manager for dermatology and antibiotics for Zoetis. So effectively, I head up those two areas from a technical perspective and provide support for both the field force and my colleagues as well. I've been in industry now for longer than I care to admit, 17 years. I worked as a vet in practice, worked in referral dermatology practice in Cheshire for a little while.
Yeah.
And then I joined Pfizer back in 2006. So it's been a long career in industry.
Oh, 17 years, that's a long time to do anything, isn't it? That's very impressive. So there must be something, you know, you must enjoy your job to stay in it for that long. So really interesting. And I think one of the it's really I think important to be chatting to you and your colleagues, because not only for, you know, the knowledge that you're sharing, but actually I genuinely think it is so good to see and to hear from people that are doing different things within the veterinary sector. And I think it's very inspiring to hear all the different ways that people have used their veterinary qualifications. So I think in itself that is inspiring, and to have stuck around for 17 years doing something is also very inspiring. So today we're continuing our kind of dermatology theme, and talking a little bit about kind of therapeutics in canine allergic skin disease. And I think one of the things that we always go back to, particularly with dermatology, actually, is that, you know, the initial diagnosis that's made in many of these cases, particularly when we're talking about allergic skin disease, is actually really important. And a couple of the things, I mean, I think obviously these are cases when we're talking about dermatology cases, when we're talking about allergic skin disease, these are cases that people are seeing all the time, like a ridiculously high number of, you know, cases, and the caseload is going to be to do with skin. But I don't know if you can talk a little bit about why maybe going back to basics and making, you know, an effective, appropriate diagnosis is still so important in these particular cases.
Yeah, for sure. And it's, you know, as you say, so dermatology cases, itch particularly, it's the main reason why dogs are presented into clinics. And it's a really interesting one when you think about things through the lens of the pet owner, in terms of they will have often picked up the signs of itch as the predominant sign. And they will have gone, usually they'll have gone via a search engine, or they'll have spoken to friends, and they'll have tried something at home. Generally, we found that around about 9 out of 10 owners had tried something already, whether that's shampoos, flea medications, dietary supplements, etc., before they come into the vet. And they get to that stage of frustration with the dog still itching. And what we find is it's a real crossroads. And obviously, it's easy for the vet to pick a effective treatment that will stop the itch or inflammation. But the problem is, if they don't make a concrete diagnosis and set expectations around addressing the underlying cause of the itch, so we're thinking parasites, bacterial or yeast disease, and then we move on to allergies, so food allergy or environmental allergies, it's going to keep coming back. And I always think about it as being a bit of a crossroads, in terms of these can be some of the most bonded clients you get if you set expectations right from the start and you line up that diagnostic process and say, we might be in this, it might be a quick cure and it might be a quick diagnosis, but it could equally be a longer one. So it's explaining that process and using the right language right from the start. And we know that obviously we have those owners that bounce around between vets in a clinic, but importantly between clinics as well. And it's one of the big reasons we know why, obviously, one of the main reasons of presentation, but also one of the main reasons why owners will bounce around between veterinary clinics unsatisfied because the diagnosis hasn't been made. So it's just so important.
Really interesting. And I think that, you know, you just have to go into, you know, particularly, you know, social media, Facebook, and actually, you know, my, you know, I suppose it depends on what you click on, but I'm very aware of actually in my feed there being you know, mention of, you know, chew, you know, give your dog this chew and it'll take away its itch. You know what? I think there's so much of that now as far as kind of accessibility to interventions online where people can go and get X, Y, and Z supplement or whatever from X, Y, and Z person. And so I think a lot of people are exposed to that, you know, online. And I think there's that trust thing as well, isn't it? Like, I think that one of the things that we really need to be focusing on in the veterinary sector is that trust with clients. And that's for lots of reasons that we'll not talk about today, that can be variable, you know, for and I think actually setting expectations and building that relationship with clients, particularly with these cases that you see, these dermatology cases, is actually more important than ever, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really setting those right expectations from the start. And as I say, you know, I've still got clients from back in my days in clinical practice that are friends, you know, clients that I made, I was seeing on a regular basis, and people that you get to know really, really well. They're coming in on a regular basis, whether it's for, might be coming in for injections or checkups, might be that they're on immunotherapy vaccines as well. And these are people that you get to see and know very well. And there is that period of, and that bonding and trust that goes alongside that, for sure.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, aside from that, though, I think that there's no doubt that the landscape has changed, particularly in dermatology. I always think this is really fascinating, is actually one of the, there's lots of things that don't change as far as what we do in veterinary medicine, but there's lots of things that do. And actually, one of the areas that is most interesting is dermatology, as far as the drugs that are available. So, you know, ultimately, there's no doubt that what we have available now for some of these itchy patients is extremely different from what we did or did not have, you know, 15, 20 years ago. So I don't know how has that changed things for you as far as drug availability and what we're doing therapeutically for these patients that we weren't doing 10, 15 years ago?
I think, you know, one of the key things that's changed is really the understanding of disease as well. So the whole understanding around the pathophysiology of itch has massively changed. In the 90s, when I graduated, it was thought to be predominantly antibody IgE driven. So antibodies attached to the surface of mast cells that caused degranulation of mast cells and histamine release. And then back in 2012, there was some work that Pfizer, then Zoetis, released where we got to understand more around the impacts of certain chemical messengers, cytokines, the interleukins that bind to inflammatory cells and also neurons. And we realized this is actually what led the drive towards itch and inflammation. So therapeutics have come with that, and more targeted therapeutics as we've gone as well. So, you know, there's no doubt that, you know, corticosteroids are incredibly effective drugs across a range of conditions. But obviously, with that broad spectrum, they do come with side effects as well. So what we've now got with the, obviously, the JAK inhibitor, ocrelizumab or Apoquel, and Cytopoint particularly being a very targeted IL-31 monoclonal antibody, we've got much more targeted medications now that can be tailored for the individual patient. And I think the nice thing is now, you know, it's not to say that they completely replace the likes of prednisolone and cyclosporin, obviously not, because they're great drugs still, but these have really sort of expanded our range, our therapeutic arsenal that we can use, and we can tailor in the individual allergic case.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's the point. I mean, I think it is very much about just having, you know, options. And I think that, you know, anytime that I would speak to dermatologists, they say exactly that it's not necessarily about one drug being the absolute, you know, go-to for every single case. You know, it's about the fact that we have, you know, more options than just prednisolone, you know. And I wish sometimes, you know, I think, you know, in the cases that I see, you know, I wish that I had more options sometimes, you know, because I think we're often signing patients up, certainly I am, you know, to lifelong steroids sometimes, not for skin disease, but for other reasons. Mm. And it would be wonderful if we had other options sometimes for that. So I think, you know, we must be kind of encouraged by the fact that things have come, you know, come on in this sort of way, and that there are more options available to us. I think on the flip side of that, I was speaking to someone the other day about this, and actually the flip side of that is just that there's so much more to learn for vet students nowadays. I think that, you know, when you look at the comparison of, you know, the dermatology teaching, you know, 15, 20 years ago, it's so different from what there is today. But I suppose we have to take the kind of positive in that. So as far, I think one of the biggest frustrations for, you know, the these dermatology patients, you've mentioned that these are clients that are not going to just come in once, get some medication and go away again. But actually, you know, they're going to be cases that will be ongoing and potentially will have, you know, if they are itchy dogs with allergic skin disease, they will have flare-ups of disease. And I suppose that's maybe kind of sort of playing into that, what you said earlier on about owners maybe becoming disheartened or, you know, a bit annoyed that actually this problem has flared up again. And obviously that plays into your expectation setting. But I don't know if you can talk a little bit about flare-ups and how we should be approaching and managing that when it comes to these patients and their longer term management.
Yeah, no, it's a really, really important point. And it's something that we've actually recently released educational materials for vets to hand out to their clients and basically to talk through when they start therapy for the allergic dog. So Obviously, there's many things that can cause flare-ups. They can get, if it is a atopic case, they can get a large exposure to the offending allergen, for example. It could be, if it's a seasonal allergy, for example. But also importantly, obviously looking at, bacterial infections, pyodermas and Malassezia overgrowth, or, flea. One thing that's often missed is a parasite infestation, further down the line. So it's really important just to make sure that the owners are aware of flare-ups, what they are, why the itch is increasing again, and also the fact of it's important to diagnose. And I think it's also really important to look at the fact that allergic disease, it's a chronic and it's a flexible process, this whole diagnostic piece. And, obviously, if we rule that infection once, it doesn't mean that we don't have to rule this out again further down the line. And the same with parasites. So it's really important that the owners recognize those signs, realize it is part and parcel of the disease. And sometimes what we'll need to do, so say they're on a stable medication like Cytopoint coming in once a month, for example, and the dog gets a flare up, they've had a big ch allergic challenge to their to whatever it is they're allergic to, grasses, weeds, pollens, or house dust mites if it's indoors. You might need to tweak your treatment. So it might be a case of adding in something like Apoquel, for example, alongside Cytopoint for a short period of time to have a sort of combined action. And also looking at other things as well, do you need to increase the frequency of topical medication, for example, as well? I think equally, it's going right back and realizing the value of cytology at all times as well, and doing that as much as possible in these cases.
I think so that's the thing, it's not it's you make a diagnosis and then that's it doesn't mean that things aren't changing, particularly in these kind of longer term patients, and going back to the basics of dermatology with the cytology, I think is, as you say, really important. But I think one of the just things that you've mentioned there that I think is really important as well is the fact that these medications are not just, standing on their own, and there is the option to use combinations of medication, combinations of injectable and topical, and also sometimes these drugs together, in order to get the best outcome for the patient. So they don't just stand in their own lane, and obviously their mechanism of action is different, and therefore they're, they can be used differently at different times. So I think that's maybe something that people wouldn't always think. That I think, particularly with, I don't know if patients are on things like Apoquel and Cytopoint, people maybe worry, well, can I use steroids alongside that for a short period of time? Is that appropriate to be using these sorts of drugs in combination?
Yeah, what we do say is that, so steroids, I would be wary of using steroids alongside certainly Apoquel together. And I know this is mooted and sort of advocated in some independent papers. We would be cautious of that because of the relative effects on the immune system. So if we're using a immunosuppressive such as a steroid, we know that Apoquel is immunomodulatory, but there will be potentially a combined dampening effect on the immune system. So what we do know is that obviously Cytopoint has a unique action on IL-31 as a mAb. So you could use Apoquel alongside that without that sort of cumulative effect on the immune system, if you like. But I'd be wary of using steroids alongside Apoquel.
But it's interesting, but you can you as far as you're concerned, you can use the Apoquel and the Cytopoint quite safely together in patients.
Yeah, that should be absolutely fine. I think, one really important point is that sometimes it's easy to think of Cytopoint being injectable Apoquel when it's very much not. It's a very different mechanism of action. So the monoclonal works outside the cell to mop up IL-31 via the binding to the antibody to the monoclonal, whereas Apoquel works inside the cell at the level of the receptor. There's an enzyme inside the cell that's Janus kinase or JAK. And by knocking that out, basically by inhibiting that, you're working intracellularly, whether that's on nerve cells or inflammatory cells. So they've got different mechanisms of action and work in very different ways. So that might be why sometimes when you use them together, I speak to dermatologists on a regular basis, and they will say there are certain cases, interestingly, that they'll respond to both together, but as soon as you take one or the other off, the itch will and the inflammation will return, which is really, really interesting. And it just explains a really sort of complex individual pathophysiology of each patient.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's exactly it. Like, I think it's, and it's looking at all of these patients. There's definitely not a one size fits all, you know, for as much as we would love that, I think for anything, it's you know, definitely not the case. And we have to look at these patients very much as individuals. But again, going back to the fact that we've got so many different options, and therefore we can, there's more than just steroids on the shelf to kind of reach for and think about in many of these cases. So as far as kind of, I suppose, you know, you've touched on this, that the you know, it would seem that really initially when we're seeing these cases, we're wanting to really do all that we can to make the best diagnosis and the diagnosis that's going to be that, you know, fit that patient and allow us to make the best therapeutic choices. But as far as kind of, and maybe where some of the frustration comes, what would be your kind of top tips or advice when it comes to the longer term management of these patients and some of the frustrations maybe that you see when things don't go right moving into the future?
Yeah, I think it's setting the right expectations at the start and letting the client know that there will be ups and downs, you know, there will be bumps in the road, but it's important that they recognise the signs and when to represent to the vet. You know, one great idea is to certainly have regular e-checks. Once a diagnosis is made, obviously, and we get onto stable therapy. So great example is Cytopoint. If the animal is stable on Cytopoint and having them back for monthly injections, one area that we've looked into, we know that vets are extremely busy now. Obviously, hours are tight. We've got increasing numbers of patients. So if we can do something to help out with consultation time, brilliant resource to use is the veterinary nurse in the practice for re-administration of Cytopoint, for example, on a monthly basis. And we've done some education for vet nurses recently. There's a real desire from the vet nursing teams to get involved here. So our suggestion is after the first couple of Cytopoint injections, the nurse can take over them and basically give those monthly injections. And we've developed recheck forms for them to do where they can talk through the disease with them. They can check other things as well. But also importantly, they can pick up any small telltale signs of disease, complications of disease like pyoderma, for example. So having those regular touch points is a really nice piece. I think other sort of tips would be to make sure that obviously it's a risk-based assessment as well, but looking at parasite coverage as well. Obviously, we do need to think about risk factors, you know, relative transmission and risk of picking up different parasites. But it's an important piece if we know that we've got a dog that is flea allergic, for example, that's a complicating factor of, it can be a complicating factor in an atopic, but that is ruled out by prophylaxis and by prevention.
Mm-hmm. I really like that. And I really like this idea that there is a, we do need to, we 100% need to make things easier for vets and nurses and veterinary professionals. I you know, I think that's an absolute godsend. And you know, I can't tell you the joy sometimes in having a form or a flowchart or a spider diagram or whatever that you can just go to and just, it tells you kind of what to do. Like, I think that, and you know, the amount of like demand there is, you know, for you know, I get asked all the time, can you not just create some sort of crib sheet or some sort of something? And I think, so obviously, you know, that our job is not, you know, just as simple as it being a formula, but I do think when we can put kind of formulas and you know, things that kind of help in that way into our day-to-day practice, then actually I think that's really helpful to people, and people are looking for that for sure. I do, you know, I always get worried when I'm lecturing and people are writing down, you know, all the words that I'm saying, and I'm like, well, no, hold on a second. It does depend a little bit on the situation, you know, but I think equally, if people can have sort of that helping hand, I think that's massively helpful. And I think particularly in these chronic patients, I did just want to go back to that, you know, the utilization of the vet nurse in chronic settings, I think is so important. Like, we could talk about that for an hour in itself, because I think that that's actually, really empowering nurses to do their job is so important. And although I think that's improved over the last, I don't know, 5, 10 years, I think there's a long way to go. And I think it's really, really interesting to hear you sort of say that in this setting as well. And maybe this is a setting that people wouldn't necessarily think of nurses being utilized in, maybe with a chronic diabetic or whatever else, but I think maybe skin is not necessarily something that people would think of. So I think really important that we're mentioning that, and hopefully people will be inspired to take that forward and to be, nurses to be more involved in these sorts of cases.
Yeah, definitely. And I, taking myself back to practice times, so whether that was first opinion practice or, referral practice in dermatology, my nurses were such a key part of my team, and in terms of helping me out with my dermatology patients as well. So even back then, they were helping me out with sampling, for example. They were helping me out with sort of rechecks as well. And there's that real appetite there as well, sort of speaking to both my colleagues. We're hearing this from practice. We're also speaking to, nurses on a daily basis in practice, and fantastic resource who want to be involved. So why not? We've developed, I say, we've developed resources for the guys as well on our nursing academy. There are some lectures there, recorded lectures and webinars in terms of how they can get involved and how they can structure that dermatology consultation as well.
Yeah, no, really, really, really interesting, and 100%, there is an appetite for that, because I think it just it makes everyone's day better. The vets have a better day because they are getting, supported in this way. The nurses have a better day because they are utilizing their skill set, and I think it just is beneficial to, to everyone. Really, and so I think that it's a really powerful use of people's skills, and I think we have to absolutely utilize that in every area. When we're talking about these kind of chronic cases, particularly with these dermatology patients, is that we're potentially asking a lot of vets from, as far as the ongoing administration of medication, but also potentially from an owner's perspective. One of the things that's maybe challenging as far as getting people on board is that we're asking a lot of them as far as management, giving medications, doing shampoos, whatever else. Is there anything that you think can help with that kind of burden that we're not just putting on vets and veterinary professionals, but also owners as far as ongoing medications are concerned?
Yeah, and I think this is such an important area. It's considering, the whole thing around caregiver burden is so important, and looking, so caregiver burden is it's the burden that's placed on the owner, or the person basically who's administering a medication long term, whether it's to a pet or they're caring for a human being, for example. And we know there's a lot of knock-on effects on the pet owner or the carer. In terms of financial, in terms of health as well. So there's physical effects via caregiver burden. And when we're thinking about the chronic allergic patient, they'll often be on multimodal therapy. So different medications, they'll be on shampoos, they'll be on obviously parasiticides often as well. And what we know is that as the number of treatments go up, the caregiver burden goes up as well in dermatological diseases. A recent study that's shown that. So if we can make things easier in some way, whether that be via a chewable medication, when we're thinking about Apoquel, or we're thinking about monthly injection, for example, with Cytopoint, and making things easier from a compliance perspective, it's got to be a win. And I think sometimes as vets, it's really easy to lose that sometimes and to not think from the pet owner's perspective. We actually ran some really interesting market research. It's a study that we ran about 18 months ago, and we knew that around about 9 out of 10 vets were satisfied with the original Apoquel profile. It's not broke, don't fix it. Okay, it's absolutely fine. So why do we need a chewable version? And we asked 250 pet owners from the UK and repeated this internationally as well. These were guys that were giving a daily medication, whether it was Apoquel or prednisolone or cyclosporine, about their preferences and what they were finding with that and the problems with that versus the profile of Apoquel Chewable, which is our obviously our flavored version. And we got some really interesting results. So we found that over two-thirds preferred the profile of giving a daily, effectively treat or palatable medication. And again, two-thirds said they were having serious issues with giving Apoquel or prednisolone on a daily basis alongside other things. They were having to disguise in food. They were feeling stressed or unhappy, building extra time into the day, and also worrying that the treatment wasn't actually working because they were missing treatments. So I think it's really important that we ask our owners. We don't just say, can you give them medication, yes or no? We ask them an open question. How do you feel about giving a daily medication alongside everything else you have to do? Can you do it? You know, is there anything that we can do that makes it easier? And then we give them the options from there.
Yeah, I think that that's important. I think that, you know, we just presume, or no, well, we do, I think, presume that it's just going to be fine. And sometimes, you know, we then, you know, take into account some, if the dog has more, or the dog or cat has more than one problem, you know, it just, the medication list can become endless and actually really daunting, very unmanageable. So I think anything we can do to alleviate some of that, particularly when you're asking someone to do something on a very regular basis, I think is actually really important. And when we, when as vets and nurses, you know, when we're faced with giving our pets medication ourselves, I think that becomes, I every time I give my cat or dog a medication, I'm like, oh yeah, you know, I remember then in that moment the challenges of asking people to do what we ask them to do. And so I think actually that we probably do kind of underestimate, you know, we dispense the bottle and then and we don't see the rest of the anxiety that goes along with that, you know. And I think there probably is a lot of owner anxiety relating to that. So I think that kind of thing is super important, particularly with these chronic conditions. That's really interesting. Well, so as always, it's a joy to chat to you. I, you know, this, you know, what's really interesting for me again is, you know, with this dermatology focus, it's the fact that things are, it's a really interesting space, you know, from a drug point of view, particularly. And I think one of the things that always, you know, I know nothing about dermatology, but one of the things that I think always comes through when we're chatting, and it seems to be that we always chat about dermatology. One day we'll chat about another something else. But I think what I love is the fact that it comes back to, for me, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the fact that actually the initial workup, the initial diagnosis, utilizing cytology is always a really, really key theme. And that's no matter who I speak to in the dermatology sphere, that's absolutely a message that comes through loud and clear. And also the fact that these are patients that are not necessarily going to go away. And in order to make that positive, we need to be managing expectations for the medium and long term. And I think that's also really, really important. And actually, not just dermatologically, but I think expectation management for me, you know, dealing with chronic cases too of a different nature, is the fundamental golden rule of any chronic medicine. If you tell someone from day one that this problem is not going to go away, then you honestly, in the most positive way, you're on to an absolute winner, because that is, you know, ultimately true, you know. And I think it does avoid disappointment later on down the line. A massive thank you to Johnny and Emma for chatting today. I just need to remind you that in order to comply with our industry code of practice, some of the products mentioned in our clinical segment are prescription-only veterinary medicines. Further information is available from the SPC or by contacting Zoetis via email, and we will pop that email address in the show notes. It's important that we always remind you that we need to use medicines responsibly. Please do check out VTX and all that we do at www.vtx-cpd.com. vetmethodexchange.com. And for more information about many of the things mentioned in the podcast today, then do check out the show notes. As always, if you have any suggestions for the podcast regarding clinical chats or people you'd like to hear me chat to, then please do drop us an email. Thank you again for listening, and I'll see you next time.